and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Here is the editor of Shirley Chisholm in her own words, speeches, and writings. Zinghe Fraser is Assistant Professor of Africana Studies and Women's and Gender Studies at Brooklyn College and Director of the Shirley Chisholm Project on Brooklyn Women Activism. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
It's great to have you on this show. There's a lot to talk about. Yeah. We go back to November 30th, 2024. We celebrated the 100th birthday of Shirley Chisholm. Your book shows that she was more than the first Black woman elected to U.S. Congress or a Black woman who decided to run for President of the United States. What might surprise a reader who picks up your book?
I think one of the things that would surprise readers is really the breadth of Chisholm's political ideologies and progressive legislative policies and engagement, right? I think most people think of her as first, but they don't think of her as a political strategist. They don't also think of her as a public intellectual, right? We are trained, in fields to think of intellectuals like W.E.B. Du Bois and, Anna Julia Cooper, or maybe someone like Toni Morrison, those who, write incessantly. But Chisholm is engaged in an intellectual enterprise during the 1960s and the 1970s. She's influenced by Black feminist intellectuals, Black feminist poets, and so she's reading those people, but she's also writing in publications throughout the 1970s. So I think, the main goal, one of the main goals of writing and compiling all of her, speeches and writings is really to place her in a context of the Black intellectual tradition. And so Chisholm really is a part of that Black intellectual tradition and is a way for us to think and broaden our perspective of her, but also Black political women during her time.
Let me ask you a personal question. How did Shirley Chisholm enter your life? Was it a speech that you saw or a book that you picked up? How did she become so important to you?
I mean, she becomes important to me as a young woman. Actually younger than a woman, right? I was a child. My mother was a medical technologist. She worked in Brooklyn. Shirley Chisholm picketed with her. There is a picture of my mother at the with a number of hospital workers at the National Museum of African American History in DC, right? Ironically, and I had no idea until I went to the exhibit. I'm like, oh my goodness, that's my mother's picture. And of course, she's in the exhibit that we have in New York City. So as a young child, I heard the stories about Shirley Chisholm and who she was. And then as I, got older and I worked my first job was working for Congressman Major Owens, who took Shirley Chisholm's seat, and coming from her district, I felt like there was really no discussion about Shirley Chisholm. And that was a long time ago. I don't want to date myself. I'm still 25, right? But, I'm literally just getting out of Temple University, having an undergraduate degree in political science and African American studies. And I was really just, interested in why no one spoke about her as much. And coming from her district, there wasn't any kind of semblance of Shirley Chisholm at that time. So when I went on to my graduate studies in Columbia and working on the Congressional Black Caucus specifically in that history, I really found that there was this gap, and it just intrigued me. And it intrigued me because there was so much not known about Chisholm. And so it's, everyone says I've had an obsession with Chisholm for a very long time because it's, dating back over 17 years now. She continues to engage me and provide new ways and entryways for me to think about politics, for me to think about immigration, colonialism, intersectionality, all of the things that we're talking about now. And the one of the good parts of the book is that it's divided in all these areas, right? Where we never thought that Chisholm is talking about the environment, right? She's talking about the prison industrial complex. She's talking about police brutality, all the things that we're talking about in our current moment, in this current state that we're in, Chisholm is talking about in 64 and 68 and 70.
Well, let's go back. Let's go back to something you just mentioned.
Okay.
Let's talk about your mother, okay? Yeah. There must be something that led her to Shirley Chisholm. And then also, did she talk about Shirley Chisholm in the house? Did you hear some stories and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, my mother was, God rest her soul, she's been deceased for almost 2 years now. But my mother was an activist from North Carolina, right? She grew up in segregation in Kinston, North Carolina. And she was a member of SNCC, and she, you know, was an activist in her own part. And coming to New York City, you know, the reason why she was connected to Chisholm was because Chisholm was picketing with hospital workers, because there was, you know, there's this old misconception that the North had all of these opportunities that the South didn't happen, right? And my mother and her family, as many other African Americans, especially in New York, come from that great migration, right? They, you know, leave North Carolina and they, you know, set up shop in New York and Brooklyn at that time. And so my mother was an activist, and a part of what was going on in New York and Brooklyn at that time was a continued effort to, you know, to ensure that there was no unionization, right? And African Americans understand how unions were so pivotal and important to maintaining a living wage and getting resources and benefits, right? And so that was, you know, some of the things. My father was also an activist and a Black nationalist in New York as well. And so I grew up in a very political, savvy, engagement as a young child. So there was no escaping books and literature and, you know, a discussion about Black history. Black history was 365 days, 24 hours in my house. So I had no, you know, there was no escaping that.
Right. Well, your house is very different from mine. I grew up in the Bronx, and the only reason why we knew about Shirley Chisholm is because she's from Barbados, and that's where my mother's family's from. It was this Bajan thing going on. And I want to open the door to that, because I want you to talk about Shirley Chisholm, is this West Indian background, specifically Barbados. And you mentioned in the book and the introduction that Shirley Chisholm's father was a follower of Marcus Garvey. And, you know, we also hear that when we talk about like Malcolm X's, father and mother being from the West Indies. Mm-hmm. And I wonder in terms of how that breaks down in terms of what we saw even between Garvey and Du Bois, African-Americans and West Indians, you know, that type of thing. And then specifically, I'm from Jamaica, not Barbados, and how that might play out. So that's a lot on you, but talk about that. Flesh out the early
I'll talk a lot about Chisholm, but my own family background. So my grandfather was Marcus Garvey Jr.'s and Julius Garvey's, Marcus Garvey's son's godfather, and my parents are godparents to Sekou Garvey, who's my godbrother. So I'm infinitely qualified to discuss Garvey and Garveyism and those engagements in terms of African Americans and Caribbean, because my grandfather and my grandmother were Jamaican, right? So
this is all coming out in this interview.
Right. You know, just, you know, the luckiness of it, right? The irony of it. So, you know, Chisholm, and what I talk about in the introduction is Chisholm has a really interesting perspective in terms of migration. So I talked about my mother's family's kind of great migration, right? But Chisholm's parents, you know, her father in particular, was very influential in terms of her developing her own political identity and her own racial pride and understanding of her own Africanness and what that meant to her through Garvey and other, you know, other Pan-African diasporic influences, right? And so that becomes a really stalwart in terms of Chisholm. Chisholm understands the world through that kind of gaze and that perspective of talking or listening to her father talk to his friends about what was going on in their home countries. And it was not only Barbados, but just think about what's going on in the world during the 19, during the time in which Chisholm is a child. And what's also ironic about Chisholm and interesting is that she has a reverse, what I call a reverse migration story, right? We always assume that migration to the United States is the place of milk and honey and opportunities. But Chisholm's family understood what was happening during the Depression. And of course, for African or Black African ancestral people in New York City, right? The Depression was they were the first hit during the Depression. And so because of the economic issues with the family, right? During the Depression, her mother sends her and her sisters back to Barbados for a significant period of time. And so that displacement, just think about it, being a child and being displaced from your mother and your father and the home that you knew because of that economic crisis, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, they went with their grandmother and they didn't feel it in that way, but it still does provide a perspective, right?
And you're growing up in Barbados and not Brooklyn.
Yes, growing up in Barbados, going to primary school in Barbados. And, you know, it's also a certain kind of, I wouldn't call superiority, but just having this idea that having a Barbadian education was going to be far advanced and far better, especially elementary education in Barbados and what her mother believed that she would receive other than being in Brooklyn, receiving that education. And I would probably agree that Chisholm probably received a better education and being surrounded. I think what we don't pay attention, and there are studies now that saying, you know, having education where your teachers are Black, or they coming from their community, creates a certain kind of racial pride and all of those other kind of things for not only for self-esteem, but also for academic excellence happened in those spaces. And so Chisholm comes out of that landscape of thinking about what diaspora means, mm-hmm. and also having an understanding about colonialism and imperialism. So, you know, while the racism that Chisholm would face and understand in the American context is prevalent, right? Excuse me. What is also under her understanding of colonialism and imperialism. So you will see, as I say in the introduction, she understood what it meant to be taught the British English, to be taught about the Empire of England, and not be taught about the indigenous people of Barbados and Black history.
Well, let's look at something that you also do in your introduction, which I think is very important, and I want to ask for some clarification on it. You talk about placing Shirley Chisholm within the tradition of Black feminist intellectual, the Black feminist intellectual tradition. And so I looked at that, and then I said, okay, Black feminist intellectual traditions. To me, that was one section. But then what about the radical Black feminist intellectual tradition? And I'm thinking of people like Angela Davis, Claudia Jones, even Lorraine Hansberry, which to me, they're a little more radical, you know? And I was wondering whether you might agree with me that there's two Black feminist intellectual traditions.
Yes, I don't make that distinction in the same way, but I do consider, and I think I draw from it a lot, Frances Beale, Claudia Jones, even Claudia Jones, who's also has her own connection to the diaspora, mm-hmm. right? They are a part of a kind of Black feminist radical tradition, especially those who are also connected to New York, as well as a larger kind of things about talking about Carnival and what that mm-hmm. means.
And they're actually, in this case, they're, you know, Davis, Jones and say Angela Davis, they're in the Communist Party.
Yes, they are, definitely. And you have people like Sonia Sanchez and others, right, who are, you know, Chisholm is reading. You know, she quotes Francis Bill in a number of her articles as well as speeches, right? And Chisholm is influenced by that radical left, right? Those who are part of the Communist Party or those who, you know, are more connected to the radicalism, but she's also still very connected and convinced about being a catalyst, right? In the Democratic Party. So, you know, while others in the Communist Party only kind of think about, you know, not necessarily abiding to the Democratic framework, Chisholm is still invested in that. And so in some ways, she's radical in the ways in which she thinks and her ideologies, but she's not committed to the same framework in terms of how power is structured in terms of the Communist Party. She's not a member.
Let's look at that. Because we could say, and that when we look at Shirley Chisholm, intellectually, we can put her in one group. But then I wonder how much because she's sort of like grassroots, how much he may have a more linking to, say, Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, she's influenced. And it's because of Fannie Lou Hamer that she even runs in 1972, right? Without the progression of really making the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party a viable way to rethink and reimagine participatory democracy, right? And that's the kind of work that, you know, Barbara Ransby talks about for Ella Baker, right? She's definitely influenced by that. She's influenced, for example, when we talk about her advocacy for domestic workers, right? If you think about some of the writings of Ella Baker talking about the Bronx slave trade, right? Literally talking about what's happening with domestic workers. So all of these things are, you know, integral in terms of her reimagining and rethinking, but also her lived experience. She knows what it looks like, and she's talked about it incessantly, right? When she's developing these legislative policies that African-American women in particular, Caribbean women, are the ones who are taking care of who? You know, white people's, you know, children, right? And what does it mean for them to not have resources in terms of everything from childcare, 24 hours, she's advocating for 24 hour childcare. She's advocating for social security benefits for domestic workers. And so she's doing all of that during that time that it's, you know, significant. There is a radical left wing that's operating in and out of spaces in Brooklyn and New York City.
You know, when we look at New York, and I'm looking at not just the radical tradition of women, but looking at what happens in New York and leaders in New York, if I had to make a comparison between the sort of Shirley Chisholm style, the politician I would think of, and you mentioned, I referenced in the introduction, Adam Clayton Powell.
Yeah.
Like you're not going to tell me what to do. You know what I'm saying? You know,
he's the female version of Adam Clayton Powell, right? She literally, and there's no other example. When people say, oh, who is she like? There wasn't a roadmap for Shirley Chisholm, right? There weren't any Black women who were operating on that scale. And the closest to the political ideology and the charisma, right? Is someone like Adam Clayton Powell. And she definitely, if you go to the exhibit in the city, you will see her and Adam Clayton Powell. There are pictures as well as portraits of her and Adam Clayton Powell during a parade for the African-American, you know, the African-American Day Parade that they have in Harlem. So she definitely is someone who really appreciated Adam Clayton Powell, his perspective, as well as his ability to be unapologetic.
You mentioned another person that comes to mind who sort of have this sort of definitely sense of power, Percy Sutton.
Yes. Well, Percy Sutton and Shirley Chisholm were in alliances together, right? They were in coalitions. They were in the New York State Assembly together. Percy Sutton also introduces her when she gives her opening speech of declaring that she's running for the presidency in 72. So she has a really good relationship with Percy Sutton.
Yeah, that's interesting because you get that connection between Percy Sutton and Malcolm X, because yes. I think he was the person that was handling, after Malcolm's assassination, he was very close to the family. So you had that interesting connection. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to talk about, we're talking about Adam Clayton, about the style. Could you talk about her as order? She had this rapid type of style, okay? Yeah. You know, yeah. which I guess it might call back to Malcolm X. But then another person who sounds like that is Lorraine Hansberry. Lorraine has this talking, and how much is that a sense of Black radicalism, you know? How much is it just New York? Is it Brooklyn, you know?
It's a combination of all of those things, right? As well as Barbados, right? Like this.
And I hear it in your voice too.
You know, I can't help it. And people are like, oh my gosh, my accent for, you know, being from Brooklyn. But, you know, it's all of those things, right? And even in my own, you know, I guess, oration, it's the influence of, I mean, mine can fluctuate between South and, you know, West Indian, but all of those kind of mixtures, and then also talking very fast. I have people who are like, okay, slow down, you talk so fast. And I'm like, oh, like, that's just, I never even think about it. So in some ways, that's the same thing for Chisholm. Chisholm is the cadence and thinking about her oratory skills. And that's why I tell people, and that's why we have in the exhibit, that it's one thing to read Chisholm, it's another thing to hear her. You know, she is a lightning bolt. And, you know, I think that's also her studying of Malcolm. When you listen to Malcolm, it's different than reading Malcolm. And her ability to also engage questions. I mean, it's a master class that I took, you know, with the late, great Manning Marable, right? Mm. I worked with him a lot at Columbia. He was one of my mentors. And he would say, just study. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just study Malcolm. And I was a part of his first Malcolm class at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And he was like, just study the way in which Malcolm answers questions, right? And it's something that, you know, I continue to be in awe at, his inability to not really pay attention. I mean, he paid attention to the questions, but really transform his answers to do his own agenda and to speak to what he wanted to. Mm-hmm. And so I think Chisholm also had a certain kind of affinity towards Malcolm in particular. Mm-hmm. And the way in which he operated and the political mind in which, and all of these things have an influence on Chisholm's oratory as well as intellectual understanding.
Let's talk about the look of Shirley Chisholm. You know, if I look at Shirley Chisholm, I said, you know, Shirley Chisholm got that look like she could be like Aretha Franklin. You know, there's an era where, you know, you had Mahalia Jackson, you know, there was a thing where women hairdos were a certain way, you know, yeah. You know, whether wigs or whatever, but they crowns or whatever, but there's that was a look.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, so, I talk a lot in my other book, my other manuscript that I'm finishing up, comparative study of Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan. I talk about the politics of style, right? I don't want to give it all away.
You both do like a movie trailer, I got another book coming out and you got to do another show with me.
Yes, yes. I mean, and I, you know, as being the historical consultant on the film Shirley with Regina King and John Ridley, I mean, we talked a lot about her fashion, right? And they got it down packed. I mean, I brought Regina and John, they came to Brooklyn to our archive at the Shirley Chisholm Project, looking at pictures and looking at video and doing those.
Well, let me ask you that. Did you tinker with the film and say, like, okay, I see this, but you're getting this a little bit wrong, and let me make a correction here?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was a part of, I didn't even have to do it because I was a part of the film from the beginning, right? From the beginning scripts. And so, yes, being the historical consultant on that film and working with participant and working with Netflix at the end, I had conversations with Regina in the middle of the night, all of those kind of things. So it was very an intense and, you know, holistic kind of process. So, and they really they really did get it right. And if you go to the exhibit, we have one of Chisholm's, one of the outfits that Regina wears in the film, and it's a part of the exhibit in New York. But Chisholm doesn't go, like I say, she doesn't go into Congress wearing a black and a brown suit. As you see in the in my background, she's wearing vibrant prints, right? Vibrant colors. And so she's engaging. One of my favorite pictures of Shirley Chisholm is her on Jet Magazine with her hat tilted to the side, ajar, and her wearing her fur.
Ajar.
Right? And her wearing her fur collar coat. You know, she embodied the style of African and Caribbean women. She loved fashion. She loved looking a certain way, but she's also very different. So that's the other thing, right? She's very, it's a different look, especially in the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. Then some of the Black Panthers and the radicals, she's not coming out with an Afro, but she's still radical, even in her mink coat, right? Like she's still talking the business, but she has a different style aesthetic. And so she's not fully like Ella Baker with the, you know, the church hat. But she, you know, is a part of that kind of, she embodies that New York style of African-American women who believe, like, when you go out, you dress.
Well, let me ask you this, because you we could line up a number of Black women running for office. We can throw in Kamala Harris and say, okay, did she dress the part? You know, did she lose the election because she didn't dress a certain way? I mean, because you're sort of saying, like, well, maybe I would have voted for her if she had a different look, you know. Did she look like an AKA or a Delta? You know what I'm saying? That whole thing.
Well, Shirley was a Delta, so.
See?
Yes, like I am. So
see, I mean, here we go. Here, you know, this is confessional. You can't get to, I know there's a lot coming out in this interview here.
Well, everyone know. I mean, most people know I'm a Delta, so. But yeah, I mean, Shirley Chisholm was a member of the Brooklyn alumni of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated. So, but no, I would say that Chisholm actually goes against the grain. It actually, she doesn't. If we want to be honest, she actually does something different than Kamala does. You know, in terms of Kamala was wearing suits and wearing, you know, pantsuits and all of that. Chisholm was not changed. She did not change her style because she was running for the presidency. Mm-hmm. She doesn't conform to the dress that a number of people are conforming in the present day. And so while we think that the moment that we're in is the most progressive, I will say in some ways it's not, right? It's in some ways it's regressive. You know, just even thinking about the ways in which we think about Michelle Obama, like I love seeing her in braids now, but she would
after she left the White House,
right? So there is a way, but Chisholm, you know, her style was consistent, and we have to understand that she is a trailblazer in that way. So when you go to the Capitol and see the picture of Shirley Chisholm, it's not of Shirley Chisholm in a black suit. It's of Shirley Chisholm in a geometric, long, you know, dress that she wore, right? And, you know, I rarely ever saw Chisholm in pants, ironically. So she is abiding to a certain kind of aesthetic, but not to the aesthetic of the men. She's not wearing boxy suit. It's also very not similar to, for example, a Barbara Jordan who wore boxy suits, who wore a little bit more conservative. She's also coming from Texas. So there's a different, you know, thing there. But Chisholm is paying homage to the Caribbean with colors. She's not afraid of those things. And that's also replicated in her own policies, her own political ideology.
Okay, we're going to take a little break here. My guest today on The Margin is Zinger A. Frazier. She is the editor of Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches, and Writings. The show is On The Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace! This is your social justice calendar for the week of February 24th, 2025.
Wednesday, February 26th is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur study group session, a screening of the documentary The Pendleton Two, They Stood Up, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info can be found on PACA social media, PACADMV. Thursday, February 27th, from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., there will be a National Reentry Network for Returning Citizens Advocacy Training located at 733 11th Street, Northeast Washington, D.C. More info can be found on the nationalreentrynetwork.org. Also on Thursday, February 27th at 6:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe will hold a discussion on the book Trinity of Fundamentals by Wissam Rafidi and plans for further liberation of the Palestinian people. Friday, February 28th, there is a talk with visiting Cuban Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Carlos Fernandez de Cosio, at the Institute for Policy Studies from 4 to 5 p.m. RSVP is required. More info can be found on ips-dc.org/events. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Zinga A. Frazier. She's the editor of Shirley Chisholm, In Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings. Zinga, let's talk about Shirley Chisholm's 1972 run for presidency. How well organized was that campaign? Who was in opposition to her running? And how did the media cover her?
So in terms of the campaign, how it was organized, Chisholm is trying to find the best way to run with the limited amount of resources and money, right? And so her decision to run in specific places where she can receive the most delegates, right? So that's part of the strategy, is to make sure that she was able to capture or gain as many delegates as possible. So she didn't have an entire, nationwide campaign where she campaigned in every state, right? She was strategic in saying that, okay.
Who was managing her campaign?
So there were it's really a hodgepodge of those. And there were people who, she did have an advisor, Wesley Meckholder, who's from New York City, who was an advisor. There were other, campaign workers. She did have a campaign manager, but then they left in the middle of the campaign. So she didn't have one central person. And a part of that was because she didn't have the money. She didn't have the resources like someone like McGovern did. Right. And so she had a hodgepodge of people who were working, whether they were in California or in North Carolina or Massachusetts. People would say, hey, we want to put you on the ballot here. And so then, she'd be like, okay, fine. You get the team together because I don't have the resources to outfit every state. And so even though the main headquarters was in, New York City, in Brooklyn, there were other states where other people took over. So that was at least a part of the strategy. Who's up against? She's up against, of course, all of the white men who are running. And the ticket was flooded by people like McGovern and George Wallace and, Lindsay. There were so many people who were running. By the time of the convention, a significant portion of them had, decided not to go through with their own campaigns. And, Chisholm does an excellent job for being African-American, being the first woman, and going and making it to convention. I tell people all the time, only until 2024 had another Black woman made it to convention. When Kamala runs prior to that, she doesn't even make it to the convention, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone pulls out before they make it to convention. But Chisholm made it to the convention in 72. And that's a tremendous feat. Just think about all of that time from 72 to 24, that time period, that span, no one was able to make it to convention. And so in terms of the coverage, I mean, Chisholm even had to fight to ensure that there was coverage, that she was treated the same ways in which the men that she was running up against. They refused to have her on Meet the Press. And she, you know, formed a lawsuit action saying that she deserves, as Maxine Waters would say, you know, give me my time, right? And so it was an uphill battle to be heard, to be engaged. Not only, you know, the media would, you know, of course, engage her in some ways because they were enamored that they had a Black woman who was running in 72. And so some of that allowed her to have coverage, but also there was, of course, intense misogyny and sexism and racism. And the combination of all of those.
Well, talk about, you know, perhaps in some sense, the lack of support from some Black elected officials.
Yes. Well, I mean, Chisholm, the idea that it was that she was crazy, and she wasn't only seen as crazy by the white media, right? And her white colleagues, she was seen crazy by Black, some of her Black colleagues. A lot of the Black elected officials, a significant portion of the Congressional Black Caucus did not support her. And in part, you know, there's always also this kind of misconception that Black men didn't support Shirley Chisholm. Yes, there were a significant portion of Black elected officials that did not support Shirley Chisholm. But in terms of the grassroots organizers and engagers and some of the activists who were really prevalent during that time, they did have a support system for Shirley Chisholm. Not only, you know, when we talk about the Black Panthers, but other kind of grassroots organizers who really believed in what Shirley Chisholm
okay.
was.
Okay, let me ask you a tough question here, okay? You provided... you talked about how you were helped with the film on yes. Shirley Chisholm. You were like a consultant. So let's make you a consultant to the Kamala Harris campaign. What would you say? Okay, what's going right? What did you do wrong? I mean, if you're looking at it in terms of just based on the knowledge that you know of Shirley Chisholm, what she had to do, do you suggest certain things in you know, like in September or October before people vote that okay, this is what you need to do?
I mean, there are so many things that you need to do, right? It's hard to say what was done wrong. I think what was done right and what she learned, maybe this is a better way. And it's not that it's difficult, right? But what I think Kamala learned, and she did, I will say that the campaign contacted me about speeches of Shirley Chisholm. The thing that I discuss at times is that at least she leans in to Shirley Chisholm. I said this when Hillary Clinton was running. The inability, and I received letters from Hillary and her staff, the inability, because I was in the New York Times, saying that she didn't lean in to saying that there was a Shirley Chisholm. She didn't mention Shirley Chisholm when she runs. Neither mm-hmm. does Barack Obama for that instance either. Right. Right. And all of these people are a part of Chisholm's legacy. The one thing that comes.
Well, how much did Jesse Jackson mention Shirley Chisholm when he was running
in
84?
He didn't mention Shirley Chisholm, but Shirley Chisholm actually helps campaign. She mm-hmm. he makes a number of steps. And she, Shirley Chisholm and Jesse Jackson, and I've interviewed briefly Jesse Jackson, you know, had a really good relationship. So Chisholm does provide that, what I consider what Robin D.G. Kelly calls as a freedom dream, right? She provides a certain kind of freedom dream for Jesse Jackson. The coalition that Chisholm is trying to pull together in 72 is the same coalition of the Rainbow Coalition. They actually call Chisholm's 72 campaign in some spaces the Rainbow Coalition, right? So all of those things are influences. But I say Hillary and Barack Obama in terms of the contemporary thing, right? Harris leans into that. She knows that she is standing on the shoulders of Shirley Chisholm more than anyone else, right? Mm-hmm. And so in an empowering Black women, the consistent, you asked me about the constituencies, but the constituencies that were the most consistent for Shirley Chisholm, whether it be locally or nationally, was Black women. Chisholm understood infinitely before anyone could say now, Black women are the base of the party. Chisholm knew they were the base of the party in this in 72.
She well, you know, when you look at the, when you look at 72, and maybe this ties into what you're saying, what she knew about the importance of women, there is this emphasis in her campaign focusing on the issue of housing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she's focusing on everything, right? She's even telling white feminists, what's wrong with you in terms of throwing away your vote when you're not talking about, you're not making McGovern be responsible for reproductive justice, you know, abortion. It's, you know, and what that looks like. And so she's saying, if you're for sisterhood, right, and we're mm-hmm. all women and hear me roar, then you would support Shirley Chisholm unilaterally. And some of them did not, right? But Black women, people like Barbara Lee and Florence Kennedy and others were saying, this is the person. We're feminists. If you're, and they're part of those other groups, especially Flo Kennedy, she's telling, you know, Betty Friedan, how are you not a delegate for Shirley Chisholm? You have to be if you're saying you are a feminist and you're participating in, you know, in the Democratic Party.
Do you think it's this, and this is the, one of those questions that appears on the op-ed peeps after the election, do you think the country is ready to elect a Black woman president?
I mean, absolutely not. The country, we have the administration that a significant portion of white men and white women what they want. That's the truth. We are in the position, in particular when people say, you know, how can you be a feminist and still vote for the present, the person who's the occupant, because now I'm going back to not naming him. Mm-hmm. That's what I had to do, you know, 4 years, whatever years ago, when he was there previously, right? That you, there is a segment of white women, not all, but a significant portion of white women who are invested in white supremacy and who are invested in misogyny and sexism.
You know, when you say that, that's interesting, because if you look at the number of white women who have been assigned to positions within this administration, it's significant.
Well, being assigned to positions versus being a recipient of...
I'm talking about cabinet positions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there are. But the point of it is that, you know, those white women are invested in ensuring that the majority of women don't receive the benefits and opportunities that women should receive, right? So they're, you know, when we talk about DEI, the people who really benefited from DEI are white women. The people who benefited from affirmative action are who? White women. So that's going against their best interest, right? But because of the fear of the Browning of this country, they are hit in caboodle under a oligarch who doesn't necessarily believe in having representation of all people.
Let's talk about something that's in your book. We're looking at Shirley Chisholm around 1982, and this is when Reagan's in office. You have a speech dealing with U.S. policy and Black refugees. Mm-hmm. Talk about that, because that seems extremely timely, mm-hmm. And very important.
Well, I mean, you know, Chisholm, her district had, and even till today, that district has a large population of Haitian refugees, right? And Haitian immigrants. And so Chisholm is looking at the immigration policy of Reagan and really being very frank is saying that it was indeed a racist policy that would allow Cuban, and in particular white Cubans, to come to this country and be seen as refugees and with a certain kind of level of respect and care and empathy. However, when it came to Haitian refugees, the ways in which the policies were administrated, how they were perceived by the government was not favorable to them or respectful. And so she calls out these kind of discrepancies in immigration policy during that time, under the Reagan administration.
Talk about we began our program talking about the Garvey connection. What was Shirley Chisholm's views about Africa?
I mean, she believed Africa was an important part of thinking about the influence of colonialism, thinking about the influence of imperialism and the ways in which they have been cut out of the economic and global markets. She's thinking about Africa in terms of its, of course, rich history and the importance of teaching, you know, even when we're talking about today, the importance of teaching African history, African American history. So she has that kind of perspective. She's really in, you know, invested and engaged in thinking about Africa and the global market. And talking about some of also the economic issues. So the work of people like Mickey Leland, right, or someone like Randall Robinson, or even, you know, the congressman from New Jersey, Payne, who was really you know, advocate for Africa and TransUnion and thinking about the ways in which people could collaborate, were all kind of influences of Garvey, but also a lot of the activists like Alumbe Brath and Kwasi G2 Kwasi in Brooklyn, who were also, you know, about talking about this kind of global. I think what people fail to remember is that you have so many activists during the 70s and the 80s who are really talking about engaging Africa in a different way, and invested in that enterprise.
All right. Let's talk about your book, Zenger Frazier, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writing, because I was curious about, I mean, how many poems did she write? I mean, you include one in the book,
Yeah,
but
they're not that many. They're about maybe what I could find. So they may be somewhere. Lord knows, there may be others. But I think they're about like 5 to 6. We couldn't get clearance for some of the other ones, so I was only able to do one. But she loved poets. She loved music. She loved, you know, the piano. She could play the piano as well. So she also had a very kind of artistic connection to the word.
Talk about how you conceptualized this book. You know, were the speeches that you had to transcribe? It was, you know, were there speeches that you discovered or articles that you discovered that you didn't know she had written? Just how did you put together and how long did it take you to put this book together?
Well, it's in the midst of COVID. And so prior to COVID, I had the idea for the book. And part of the reason why I conceptualized the book was because, as an academic who loves to be in the archive, I realized that I couldn't go to the archive during COVID. The libraries were closed. And so it was like, what other thing could I produce or create? And I was also with my pregnant with my son. So thinking about the ways in which I could, you know, navigate certain things. So that was the onus of, you know, you take a lemon, get lemonade. And so in terms of the structure of the book, I knew very well because I was working on this other book, The Breath of Shirley Chisholm. And what really intrigued me was the lack of understanding that people had about Chisholm. And not through their own, not through a writer's gaze, but what she said. Right. And I was really tired of seeing people write things that had no idea about Chisholm, right? And I was like, but if you read her speeches, if you understood what she said, then you would really know who she was. And I wanted to give it as a resource, as a teacher who teaches students every year, right? I have a fascination with primary documents. Mm. I force students to actually go into the library. It exists, right? to see what a primary document looks like, because they have no idea. Everything is not on Wikipedia, and the stuff that's on Wikipedia is wrong.
May not be correct, right?
Right, exactly. So I wanted people to have Chisholm for who she was and what she said. Not, mm-hmm. yes, I give an introduction, but I wanted to give the primary sources to mm-hmm. individuals, whether they be a student or they're just interested in knowing. And I wanted to show the breadth of Shirley Chisholm's intellectual understandings. And so that's why it's divided up in all of those areas.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the exhibit that's at the Museum of the City of New York, Changing the Face of Democracy, Shirley Chisholm at 100. Talk briefly about that.
So the exhibit is something that I never imagined, right? As being as a co-curator of the first museum exhibition for Shirley Chisholm solely was indeed an honor. And it provides all of the ways in which we can reimagine Shirley Chisholm, everything from her upbringings to what her legacy looks like. It's interactive, where students can, you know, go and touch and listen to Shirley Chisholm's speeches. You can see Shirley Chisholm's fashion. You can see the West Indian.
All the things we've been discussing on this show.
Yeah, right? The West Indian Day Parade. You can actually vote. We have a voting booth where people can actually mm-hmm. you know, from New York City, what it would be like to be in the voting booth to vote for Shirley Chisholm. So it's an interactive.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you right. Okay, I'm going to have to stop you right there, Zinger, Frazier. But I want to ask you this last question and then go out on this. Do you consider Shirley Chisholm a catalyst for change?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because she transforms who should be at the top of the ticket. She transforms how people see themselves in an engagement in democracy. And so because of that, she was the catalyst for change.
And because of you, Zinger Frazier, we know who Shirley Chisholm is. Okay. My guest today has been Zinger Frazier. She's the editor of Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writing. She is also assistant professor of Africana Studies and Women's and Gender Studies at Brooklyn College and director of the Shirley Chisholm Project on Brooklyn Women Activism. The show's on the margin. My name is Edward Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of her major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The WPFW family mourns the loss of longtime host and producer Larry Applebaum, who passed away peacefully on Friday, February 21st at age 67. WPFW listeners will fondly remember Larry's The Sound of Surprise, which had been a staple of Sunday afternoons from its inception in 1981 until May 2024. An accomplished archivist and internationally recognized jazz scholar, Larry spent his entire professional life at the Library of Congress, serving most recently as a senior music reference specialist in the music division. Larry played a key role in locating the original tapes of a 1957 Carnegie Hall concert featuring Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. After decades in storage, the recording was finally issued by Blue Note in 2005 to great acclaim. In addition, Larry traveled the world to lecture about jazz and was a frequent contributor to several jazz journals, including Jazz Times and Downbeat. Per his family's request, in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to WPFW at WPFWFM.org or by sending a check to WPFW, P.O. Box 42099, Washington, D.C. 20015. A celebration of Larry's life is in the planning stages. Stay tuned to WPFW for further details as they become available.
Hello, I am Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays, 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Thursday, February 27th, the Howard University Department of Political Science and Howard Uquame Ture Society present the event Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, with veteran Black Panther Party member, Black Liberation Army leader, and former political prisoner Daruba Bin-Wahad, who will deliver an analysis on how today's resurgent right-wing agenda is an outgrowth of the ongoing and historical political struggle and what fight-back strategies should look like. That's Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, Thursday, February 27th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Howard University's Douglas Hall, Room 221, at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, D.C. More information and registration for this event can be found on the webpage, daruba@howard.eventbrite.com. That's D-H-O-R-U-B-A at, that's A-T, howard.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Diversity Fund is a grassroots grant source for change makers of color in the nation's capital. We fund social justice work by and for DC people of the global majority. The deadline for submissions is Friday, March 21st. Details and application information are available at www.diversity.org.